And good afternoon on this King's birthday. It's Rod McClure with our Monday afternoon book reading. And we've been reading Ivanhoe. But before we do that, a word from the people who help make our station go so well.
Our sponsor, IGA Braidwood, is an independent retailer supporting the local community of Braidwood and the surrounding villages.
They have a wide range of specialist foods, wines, beers and spirits.
They provide free delivery in the town of Braidwood.
And they still provide old-fashioned friendly service.
Located at 50 Waller Street and open 7 days a week.
They can be contacted on 4842 2451.
Dulla Curtains and Blinds, trusted for more than 50 years for Australian-made quality. We can enhance your indoor-outdoor lifestyle. Discover Australia's largest range of outdoor blinds and awnings and keep your home insulated from the elements with eco-friendly fabrics and easy-to-use automation. Experience a whole new level of service and book your free design, measure and quote today. The easiest way to upgrade your home. Dulla Curtains and Blinds. Value in every dollar.
Your nearest store is at Batemans Bay at 21 Princess Highway, and you can contact them by phone on 4472 8033. A proud sponsor of Braidwood FM.
JG Earthworks is your one-stop shop for all your excavation needs. From big to small, Joel and his team do it all. Landscaping, backyard cleanups, roadworks and driveways, site clearing and levelling, dam cleaning and construction, motocross and supercross tracks. Check out his website at www.jgearthworks.com to get a full view of services available. Or call Joel on 0406 869 618 for a free quote and expert advice. Let JG Earthworks do your dirty work. JG Earthworks, proud supporter of Braidwood FM.
Looking for a building carpentry company for minor home refurbishments, commercial factory maintenance, farm infrastructure such as stables, yards and arenas?
Then call Peter at ECP, the experienced construction professionals with over 30 years of commercial and residential works throughout New South Wales.
Braidwood based and now servicing the coast of Canberra, Goulburn and Nowra.
Contact Peter for a chat about your next project on 0410 698 734.
ECP, a proud sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And as always, a big thank you to our sponsors. And with their support, our station just goes from strength to strength. Well, we've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. And we're at the stage where the castle of Fontgibeauf is under attack. Ivanhoe is trying to recover from his wound being tended by Rebecca, who has used Miriam's ointment, which has almost magical properties, and well, we're about to see what happens when Saxon yeomanry runs into Norman fighters. Chapter 29. A moment of peril is often also a moment of open-hearted kindness and affection. We are thrown off our guard by the general agitation of our feelings and betray the intensity of those which at more tranquil periods, our prudence at least conceals if it cannot altogether suppress them. In finding herself once more by the side of Ivanhoe, Rebecca was astonished at the keen sensation of pleasure which she experienced, even at a time when all around them both was danger, if not despair. As she felt his pulse and inquired after his health, there was a softness in her touch and in her accents, implying a kinder interest than she would herself have been pleased to have voluntarily expressed. Her voice faltered and her hand trembled, and it was only the cold question of Ivanhoe, "Is it you, gentle maiden?" which recalled her to herself and reminded her the sensations which she felt were not and could not be mutual. A sigh escaped, but it was scarcely audible, and the questions which she asked the knight concerning his state of health were put in the tone of calm friendship. Ivanhoe answered her hastily that he was, in point of health, as well, indeed better, than he could have expected. "Thanks," he said, "dear Rebecca, for thy helpful skill." "He calls me dear Rebecca," said the maiden to herself, "but it is in a cold and careless tone which ill suits the word. His warhorse, his hunting hound, are dearer to him than a despised Jewess." My mind, gentle maiden," continued Ivanhoe, "is more disturbed by anxiety than my body with pain. From the speeches of these men who were my warders just now, I learn that I am a prisoner, and, if I judge it aright, the loud, hoarse voice which even now dispatched them on some military duty. I am in the castle of Front de Boeuf. If so, how will this end? And how can I protect Rowena, my father? He names not the Jew or Jewess, said Rebecca internally. Yet what is our portion in him? And how justly am I punished by heaven for letting my thoughts dwell upon him? She hastened after this brief self-accusation to give Ivanhoe what information she could, but it amounted only to this, that the Templar Bois Guilbert and the Baron Front de Boeuf were commanders within the castle, that it was beleaguered from without, but by whom she knew not. She added that there was a Christian priest within the castle who might be possessed of more information. A Christian priest? Said the knight joyfully. Fetch him hither, Rebecca, if you can. Say a sick man desires his ghostly counsel. Say what you want, but bring him. Something I must do or attempt, but how can I determine until I know how matters stand outside? Rebecca, in compliance with the wishes of Ivanhoe, made that attempt to bring Cedric into the wounded knight's chamber, which was defeated, as we have already seen, by the interference of Ulfric, who had been also on the watch to intercept the supposed monk. Rebecca retired to communicate to Ivanhoe the result of her errand. They had not much leisure to regret the failure of this source of intelligence, or to contrive by what means it might be supplied, for the noise within the castle, occasioned by the defensive preparations which had been considerable for some time, now increased into tenfold bustle and clamour. The heavy yet hasty step of the men-at-arms traversed the battlements or resounded on the narrow and winding passages and stairs which led to the various bartizans and points of defence. The voices of the knights were heard, animating their followers or directing means of defence, while their commands were often drowned in the clashing of armour or the clamorous shouts of those whom they addressed. Tremendous as these sounds were, and yet more terrible from the awful event which they presaged, there was a sublimity mixed with them, which Rebecca's high-toned mind could feel in that moment of terror. Her eye kindled, although the blood fled from her cheeks, and there was a strong mixture of fear and a thrilling sense of the sublime as she repeated, half-whispering to herself, half-speaking to her companion, the sacred text. The quiver rattleth, the glittering spear and the shield, the noise of the captains and the shouting. But Ivanhoe was like the warhorse of that sublime passage, glowing with impatience at his inactivity and with his ardent desire to mingle in the affray of which these sounds were the introduction. If I could but drag myself, he said, to yonder window, that I might see how this brave game is like to go, if I had but a bow to shoot a shaft or a battle axe to strike, were it but a single blow for our deliverance. Ah, it's in vain, it's in vain. I am alike nerveless and weaponless. Fret not thyself, noble knight, answered Rebecca. The sounds have ceased of a sudden. It may be they join not battle. You know none of it, said Wilfred impatiently. This dead pause only shows that the men are at their posts on the walls and expecting instant attack. What we have heard, well, that is but the distant muttering of the storm. It will burst soon in all its fury. Ah, could I but reach that window? You will but injure yourself in the attempt, noble knight, replied his attendant. Observing his extreme solicitude, she firmly added, I myself will stand at the lattice, and describe to you as I can what passes. No, 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 you must not, you shall not, exclaimed Ivanhoe. Each lattice, each opening will soon be a mark for the archers, some random shaft. It shall be welcome, murmured Rebecca, as with firm pace she ascended two or three steps which led to the window of which they spoke. Rebecca, dear Rebecca, this is no maiden's pastime. Do not expose yourself to wounds and death, and render me forever miserable for having given the occasion. At least cover yourself with yon ancient buckler, and show as little of your person at the lattice as you can. Following with wonderful promptitude the directions of Ivanhoe, and availing herself of the protection of the large ancient shield, which she placed against the lower part of the window, Rebecca, with tolerable security to herself, could witness part of what was passing outside the castle, and report to Ivanhoe the preparations which the assailants were making for the storm. Indeed, the situation which she thus obtained was peculiarly favourable for this purpose, because being placed on an angle of the main building, Rebecca could not only see what passed beyond the precincts of the castle, but also commanded a view of the outwork likely to be the first object of the meditated assault. It was an exterior fortification of no great height or strength, intended to protect the postern gate through which Cedric had been recently dismissed by Front de Boeuf. The castle moat divided this species of barbican from the rest of the fortress, so that, in case of its being taken, it was easy to cut off the communication with the main building by withdrawing the temporary bridge. In the outwork was a sallyport corresponding to the postern of the castle, and the whole was surrounded by a strong palisade. Rebecca could observe from the number of men placed for the defence of this post that the besieged entertained apprehensions for its safety, and from the mustering of the assailants in a direction nearly opposite to the outwork, it seemed no less plain that it had been selected as a vulnerable point of attack. These appearances she hastily communicated to Ivanhoe, and added that the skirts of the wood seem lined with archers, although only a few are advanced from its shadow. "Under what banner?" asked Ivanhoe. "Under no ensign of war which I can see," answered Rebecca. "Singular novelty," muttered the knight, "to advance to storm such a castle without pennon or banner displayed. Seest thou who they be that act as leaders?" "Ah, it is a knight, clad in black armour." "He is the most conspicuous," said the Jewess. "He alone is armed from head to heel, and seems to assume the direction of all around him." "What device does he bear on his shield?" replied Ivanhoe. "Something resembling a bar of iron and a padlock painted blue on the black shield." "A fetterlock and a shackle bolt, azure," said Ivanhoe. "I know not who may bear the device, but well, it may have been mine own. Can you not see the motto?" "I can scarcely see the device itself at this distance," replied Rebecca. "But when the sun glances fair upon his shield, it shows it as I tell you." "Seem there no other leaders?" exclaimed the anxious inquirer. "None of mark and distinction that I can behold from this station," said Rebecca. "But doubtless the other side of the castle is also being assailed. They appear even now preparing to advance. Oh, God of Zion, protect us! What a dreadful sight! Those who advance first bear huge shields and defences made of planks. The others follow, bending their bows as they come on. They raise their bows. Oh, God of Moses, forgive the creatures you have made." Her description was here suddenly interrupted by the signal for assault, which was given by the blast of a shrill bugle, and at once answered by a flourish of the Norman trumpets from the battlements, which, mingled with the deep and hollow clang of the knackers, a species of kettle drum, retorted in notes of defiance the challenge of the enemy. The shouts of both parties augmented the fearful din, the assailants crying, "St. George for Merry England!" and the Normans answering them with cries of, "En avant, de Bracy! Boscant, Boscant!" their different commanders. It was not, however, by clamour that the contest was to be decided, and the desperate efforts of the assailants were met by an equally vigorous defence on the part of the besieged. The archers, trained by their woodland pastimes to the most effective use of the longbow, shot, to use the appropriate phrase of the time, so wholly together that no point at which a defender could show the least part of his person escaped their clothyard shafts. By this heavy discharge, which continued as thick and sharp as hail, while notwithstanding every arrow had its individual aim, and flew by scores together against each embrasure and opening in the parapets, as well as at every window where a defender either occasionally had post or might be suspected to be stationed, by this sustained discharge, two or three of the garrison were slain and several others wounded. But, confident in their armour of proof and in the cover which their situation afforded, the followers of Front de Boeuf and his allies showed an obstinacy in defence proportioned to the fury of the attack, and replied with the discharge of their large crossbows, as well as with their longbows, slings, and other missile weapons, to the close and continued shower of arrows, and as the assailants were necessarily but indifferently protected, did considerably more damage than they received at their hand. The whizzing of shafts and missiles on both sides was only interrupted by the shouts which arose when either side inflicted or sustained some notable loss. "I must lie here like a bedridden monk," exclaimed Ivanhoe, "while the game that gives me freedom or death is played out by the hand of others. Look from the window once again, kind maiden, but beware that you are not marked by the archers beneath. Look out once more and tell me if they yet advance to the storm." With patient courage, strengthened by the interval which she had employed in mental devotion, Rebecca again took post at the lattice, sheltering herself, however, so as not to be visible from beneath. "What do you see, Rebecca?" again demanded the wounded knight. "Nothing but the cloud of arrows flying so thick as to dazzle my eyes and to hide the bowmen who shoot them." "That cannot endure," said Ivanhoe. "If they press not right on to carry the castle by pure force of arms, the archery may avail little against stone walls and bulwarks. Look for the knight of the Fetterlock, fair Rebecca, and see how he bears himself, for as the leader is, so will his followers be." "I do not see him," said Rebecca. "Foul craven," exclaimed Ivanhoe. "Does he blanch from the helm when the wind blows highest?" "No, he blanches not, he blanches not," said Rebecca. "I see him now. He heads a body of men close under the outer barrier of the barbican. They pull down the piles and the palisades. They hew down the barriers with axes. His high black plume floats abroad over the throng, like a raven over the field of the slain. Oh, they've made a breach in the barriers. They rush in. They are thrust back. Front de Boeuf heads the defenders. I see his gigantic form above the press. They throng again to the breach, and the pass is disputed hand to hand, man to man. Oh, God of Jacob! It is the meeting of two fierce tides, the conflict of two oceans moved by adverse winds." She turned her head from the lattice, as if unable longer to endure a sight so terrible. "Look again, Rebecca," said Ivanhoe, mistaking the cause of her retiring. "The archery must in some degree have ceased since they are now fighting hand to hand. Look again, there is now less danger." Rebecca again looked out, and almost immediately exclaimed, "Holy prophets of the law! Front de Boeuf and the Black Knight fight hand to hand, in the breach, amid the roar of their followers, who watch the progress of the strife. Heaven strike with the cause of the oppressed and the captive!" She then uttered a loud shriek and exclaimed, "He is down! He is down!" "Who is down?" cried Ivanhoe. "For our dear lady's sake, tell me which has fallen." "The Black Knight," answered Rebecca faintly, then instantly again shouted with joyful eagerness, But no, the name of the Lord of Hosts be blessed. He is on foot again, and fights as if there were 20 men's strength in his single arm. His sword is broken. He snatches an axe from a yeoman. He presses front to Boeuf with blow on blow. The giant stoops and totters like an oak under the steel of the woodman. He falls. "Front de Boeuf?" exclaimed Ivanhoe. "Front de Boeuf," answered the Jewess. "His men rush to the rescue, headed by the haughty Templar. Their united force compels the champion to pause. They drag Front de Boeuf within the walls." "The assailants have won the barriers, have they not?" said Ivanhoe. They have, exclaimed Rebecca. "And they press the besieged hard upon the outer wall. Some plant ladders, some swarm like bees, and endeavour to ascend upon the shoulder of each other. They go down, oh no, they're throwing stones and beams and trunks of trees upon their heads. And as fast as they bear the wounded to the rear, fresh men supply their places in the assault. Oh, great God, hast thou given men your own image that it should be thus cruelly defaced by the hands of their brethren?" "Think not of that," said Ivanhoe. "This is no time for such thoughts. Who yield? Who push their way?" "The ladders are thrown down," replied Rebecca, shuddering. "The soldiers lay grovelling under them like crushed reptiles. The besieged have the better." "St. George strike for us," exclaimed the knight. "Do the false yeomen give way?" "No," exclaimed Rebecca. "They bear themselves right yeomanly. The Black Knight approaches the postern with his huge axe. The thundering blows which he deals, you may hear them above all the din and shouts of the battle. Stones and beams are hailed down on the bold champion. He regards them no more than if they were thistledown or feathers." "Ah, by St. Joan of Acre," said Ivanhoe, raising himself joyfully on his couch, "methought there was but one man in England that might do such a deed." The postern gate shakes," continued Rebecca. "It crashes. It is splintered by his blows. They rush in. The outworkers won. Oh, God, they hurl the defenders from the battlements. They throw them into the moat. Oh, men, if ye be indeed men, spare them that can resist no longer. The bridge, which communicates with the castle. Have they won it?" exclaimed Ivanhoe. "No," replied Rebecca. "The Templar has destroyed the plank on which they crossed. Few of the defenders escape with him into the castle. The shrieks and cries which you hear tell the fate of the others. Alas, I see it is still more difficult to look upon victory than upon battle." "What do they do now, maiden?" said Ivanhoe. "Look forth yet again. This is no time to faint at bloodshed." "It is over for the time," answered Rebecca. "Our friends strengthen themselves within the outwork which they have mastered. It affords them so good a shelter from the foeman's shot that the garrison only bestow a few bolts on it from interval to interval, as if rather to disquiet than effectually to injure them." "Our friends," said Wilfred, "will surely not abandon an enterprise so gloriously begun and so happily attained. Oh no, I will put my faith in the good knight whose axe has rent heart of oak and bars of iron. Singular," he again muttered to himself, "there be two men who can do a deed of such daring do, a fetterlock and a shackle bolt on a field sable. What may that mean? See they are nothing else, Rebecca, by which the Black Knight may be distinguished?" "Nothing," said the Jewess. "All about him is black, as the wing of the night raven. Nothing I can spy that can mark him further. But having once seen him put forth his strength in battle, I think I could know him again among a thousand warriors. He rushes to the fray as if he were summoned to a banquet. There is more than mere strength. There seems as if the whole soul and spirit of the champion were given to every blow which he deals upon his enemies. Oh, God, God, please forgive him of the sin of bloodshed. It is fearful, yet magnificent, to behold how the arm and heart of one man can triumph over hundreds." "Rebecca," said Ivanhoe, "you have painted a hero. Surely they rest but to refresh their forces, or to provide the means of crossing the moat. Under such a leader as you have spoken this knight to be, there are no craven fears, no cold-blooded delays, no yielding up a gallant enterprise, since the difficulties which render it arduous render it glorious. I swear by the honour of my house, I vow by the name of my bright lady love, I would endure 10 years' captivity to fight one day by that good knight's side in such a quarrel as this." "Alas," said Rebecca, leaving her station at the window and approaching the couch of the wounded knight, "this impatient yearning after action, this struggling with and repining at your present weakness, will not fail to injure your returning health. How would you hope to inflict wounds on others and yet be healed and get over the wounds you have received?" "Rebecca," he replied, "you know not how impossible it is for one trained to actions of chivalry to remain passive as a priest or a woman when they are acting deeds of honour around him. The love of battle is the food upon which we live. The dust of the Malay is the breath of our nostrils. We live not, we wish not to live longer than while we are victorious and renowned. Such, maiden, are the laws of chivalry to which we are sworn, and to which we offer all that we hold dear." "Alas," said the fair Jewess, "and what is it, valiant knight, save an offering of sacrifice to a demon of vain glory, and a passing through the fire of Moloch? What remains to you as the prize of all the blood you have spilled, of all the travail and pain you have endured, of all the tears which your deeds have caused when death has broken the strong man's spear and overtaken the speed of his warhorse?" "What remains?" cried Ivanhoe. "Glory, maiden, glory, which gilds our sepulchre, it embalms our name." "Glory," continued Rebecca, "alas, is the rusted mail which hangs as a hatchment over the champion's dim and mouldering tomb, is the defaced sculpture of the inscription which the ignorant monk can hardly read to the inquiring pilgrim. Are these sufficient rewards for the sacrifice of every kindly affection, for a life spent miserably, that you may make others miserable? Or is there such virtue in the rude rhymes of a wandering bard that domestic love, kindly affection, peace, happiness are so wildly bartered to become the hero of those ballads which vagabond minstrels sing to drunken churls over their evening ale? Oh, by the soul of Hereward, replied the knight impatiently, you speak, maiden, of... you know nothing of what you speak. You would quench the pure light of chivalry, which alone distinguishes the noble from the base, the gentle knight from the churl and the savage, which rates our life far beneath the pitch of our honour, raises us victorious over pain, toil and suffering, and teaches us to fear no evil but disgrace. You are no Christian, Rebecca, and to you are unknown those high feelings which swell the bosom of a noble maiden when her lover hath done some deed of enterprise which sanctions his fame. Chivalry, maiden, she is a nurse of pure and high affection, the stay of the oppressed, the redresser of grievances, the curb of the power of the tyrant. Nobility were but an empty name without her. And liberty finds the best protection in her lance and her sword. I am indeed, said Rebecca, sprung from a race whose courage was distinguished in the defence of their own land, but who warred not, even while yet a nation, save at the command of the deity, or in defending their country from oppression. The sound of the trumpet wakes Judah no longer, and her despised children are now but the unresisting victims of hostile and military oppression. Well have you spoken, Sir Knight, until the God of Jacob shall raise up for his chosen people a second Gideon or a new Maccabeus, it ill beseems the Jewish damsel to speak of battle or of war. The high-minded maiden concluded the argument in a tone of sorrow, which deeply expressed her sense of the degradation of her people, embittered perhaps by the idea that Ivanhoe considered her as one not entitled to interfere in a case of honour, and incapable of entertaining or expressing sentiments of honour and generosity. How little he knows his bosom, this bosom, she said, to imagine that cowardice or meanness of soul must needs be its guests, because I have censured the fantastic chivalry of the Nazarenes. Would to heaven that the shedding of my own blood, drop by drop, could redeem the captivity of Judah. No, no, would to God it could avail to set free my father and his benefactor from the chains of the oppressor. The proud Christian should then see whether the daughter of God's chosen people dared not to die as bravely as the vainest Nazarene maiden that boasts her descent from some petty chieftain of the rude and frozen north. She then looked towards the couch of the wounded knight. He sleeps, she said. Nature, exhausted by sufferance and waste of spirits, his wearied frame embraces the first moment of temporary relaxation to sink into slumber. Alas, is it a crime that I should look upon him when it may be for the last time? When yet but a short space and those fair features will be no longer animated by the bold and buoyant spirit which forsakes them not even in sleep. When the nostril shall be distended, the mouth agape, the eyes fixed and bloodshot, and when the proud and noble knight may be trodden on by the lowest caitiff of this accursed castle, yet stir not when the heel is lifted up against him. And my father, oh my father, evil is it with his daughter when his grey hairs are not remembered because of the golden locks of youth. What know I but these evils are the messengers of Jehovah's wrath to the unnatural child who thinks of a stranger's captivity before her parents, who forgets the desolation of Judah, and looks upon the comeliness of a Gentile and a stranger. But I will tear this folly from my heart, though every fibre bleeds as I rend it away. She wrapped herself closely in her veil and sat down at a distance from the couch of the wounded knight, and her back turned towards it, fortifying or endeavouring to fortify her mind not only against the impending evils from without, but also against those treacherous feelings which assailed her from within. Chapter 30. During the interval of quiet which followed the first success of the besiegers, while the one party was preparing to pursue their advantage, and the other to strengthen their means of defence, The Templar and De Bracy held brief council together in the hall of the castle. "Where is Front de Boeuf?" said the latter, who had superintended the defence of the fortress on the other side. "Men say he has been slain." "Oh, he lives," said the Templar, coolly. "Oh, lives as yet, but had he worn the bull's head of which he bears the name, and 10 plates of iron to fence it withal, he must have gone down before the fatal axe. Yet a few hours, and Front de Boeuf is with his fathers. A powerful limb lopped off Prince John's enterprise." "And a brave addition to the kingdom of Satan," said De Bracy. "This comes of reviling saints and angels, and ordering images of holy things and holy men to be flung down on the heads of those rascal yeomen." "Oh, you are a fool," said the Templar. "Your superstition is upon a level with Front de Boeuf's want of faith. Neither of you can render a reason for your belief or unbelief." "Please, Sir Templar," replied De Bracy, "I pray you to keep better rule with your tongue when I am the theme of it. By the Mother of Heaven, I am a better Christian man than you and your fellowship, for the bruit goeth surely out that the most holy order of the Temple of Zion nursed not a few heretics within its bosom, and that Sir Brian de Bois Guilbert is of the number." "Oh, care not for such reports," said the Templar, "but let us think of making good the castle. How fought these villain yeomen on your side?" "Like fiends incarnate," said De Bracy. "They swarmed close up to the walls, headed, as I think, by the knave who won the prize of the archery. I knew his horn and the baldric. And this is old Fitzurse's boasted policy, encouraging these knaves to rebel against us. Had I not been armed in proof, the villain had marked me down 7 times with as little remorse as if I had been a buck in season. He told every rivet of my armour with a cloth-yard shaft that wrapped against my ribs with as little compunction as if my bones had been of iron. But that I wore a shirt of Spanish mail under my plate coat, I had been fairly sped on my way." "But you maintained your post," said the Templar. "We lost the outwork on our part." "That is a shrewd loss," said De Bracy. "The knaves will find cover there to assault the castle more closely, and may, if not well matched, gain some unguarded corner of a tower or some forgotten window, and so break in upon us. Our numbers are too few for the defences of every point, and the men complain that they can nowhere show themselves, but they are the mark for as many arrows as a parish butt on a holiday. Errant Front de Boeuf is dying too, so we will get no more aid from his bull's head and his brutal strength. How think you, Sir Brian? Were it not better make a virtue of necessity and compound with the rogues by delivering up our prisoners?" "How?" exclaimed the Templar. "Deliver up our prisoners and stand an object alike of ridicule and execration as the doughty warriors who dared by a night attack to possess themselves of the persons of a party of defenceless travellers, yet could not make good a strong castle against a vagabond troop of outlaws led by swineherds and jesters and the very refuse of mankind. Shame on your counsel, Maurice de Bracy. The ruins of this castle shall bury both my body and my shame ere I consent to such a base and dishonourable proposition." "Let us to the walls, then," said De Bracy carelessly. "That man never breathed, be he Turk or Templar, who held life at a lighter rate than I do. But I trust there is no dishonour in wishing I had here some 2 scores of my gallant troop of free companions. Ah, my brave lancers, if you knew but how hard your captain were this day bested, how soon would I see my banner at the head of your clump of spears, and how short would be these rabble villains standing to endure you when you encountered them." "Wish for whom you will," said the Templar, "but let us make what defences we can with the soldiers who remain. They are chiefly Front de Boeuf's followers, hated by the English for 1,000 acts of insolence and oppression." "The better," said De Bracy. "The rugged slaves will defend themselves to the last drop of their blood before they encounter the revenge of the peasants outside. Let us up and be doing then, Brian de Bois Guilbert, and live or die, you shall see Maurice de Bracy bear himself this day as a gentleman of blood and of lineage." "To the walls," answered the Templar, and they both ascended the battlements to do all that skill could dictate and manhood accomplish in defence of the place. They readily agreed that the point of greatest danger was that opposite to the outwork of which the assailants had possessed themselves. The castle indeed was divided from that barbican by the moat, and it was impossible that the besiegers could assail the post and door with which the outwork corresponded without surmounting that obstacle. But it was the opinion both of the Templar and De Bracy that the besiegers, if governed by the same policy their leader had already displayed, would endeavour by a formidable assault to draw the chief part of the defenders' observation to this point, and take measures to avail themselves of every negligence which might take place in the defence elsewhere. To guard against such an evil, their numbers only permitted the knights to place sentinels from space to space along the walls in communication with each other, who might give the alarm whenever danger was threatened. Meanwhile, they agreed that De Bracy should command the defence of the postern, and that the Templar should keep with him a score of men, or thereabouts, as a body of reserve, ready to hasten to any other point which might be suddenly threatened. The loss of the barbican had also this unfortunate effect, that notwithstanding the superior heights of the castle walls, the besieged could not see from them with the same precision as before. The operations of the enemy, for some straggling underwood, approached so near the sallyport of the outwork that the assailants might introduce into it whatever force they thought proper, not only under cover, but even without the knowledge of the defenders. Utterly uncertain, therefore, upon what point the storm was to burst, De Bracy and his companions were under the necessity of providing against every possible contingency, and their followers, however brave, experienced the anxious dejection of mind incident to men enclosed by enemies who possessed the power of choosing their time and their mode of attack. Meanwhile, the lord of the beleaguered and endangered castle lay upon a bed of bodily pain and mental agony. He had not the usual resource of bigots in that superstitious period, most of whom were wont to atone for the crimes they were guilty of by liberality to the church, stupefying by this means their terrors by the idea of atonement and forgiveness. And although the refuge which success thus purchased was no more like to the peace of mind which follows on sincere repentance than the turbid stupefaction procured by opium resembles healthy and natural slumbers, it was still a state of mind preferable to the agonies of awakened remorse. But among the vices of Front de Boeuf, a hard and griping man, avarice was predominant, and he preferred setting church and churchmen at defiance to purchasing from them pardon and absolution at the price of treasure and manners. Nor did the Templar, an infidel of another stamp, justly characterise his associate when he said Front de Boeuf could assign no cause for his unbelief and the contempt for the established faith. For the Baron would have alleged that the church sold her wares too dear, and that the spiritual freedom which she put up for sale was only to be bought, like that of the chief captain of Jerusalem, with a great sum. And Front de Boeuf preferred denying the virtue of the medicine to paying the expense of the physician. Well, we're at an interesting point. Front de Boeuf, what is going to be his fate? He's dying, but then there's many ways to die. And De Bracy and Bois Guilbert, can they defend the castle from the mysterious Black Knight, Friar Tuck, and Locksley? Not to mention the swineherd, Garth. We'll have to wait till next Monday. Until then, Braidwood, keep well, stay warm.